Welcome back to the Cracco Real Estate Roundtable for this sector expert interview with Dr. Lawrence Yoon, Chief Economist, overseeing the research group at the National Association of Realtors. I'm Andrea Senni, Technology Growth Strategist, founder of the Siri Collaborative Platform, brokerage owner, and host here at the Cracco AI Roundtable, your all-in-one comprehensive view of what's happening in the real estate industry, straight from some of the earliest industry adopters, technology adopters, and foremost experts. And today joining us is co-host Dan Wagner, Senior Vice President, Government Relations at Inland, good friend, and our sector expert, Dr. Lawrence Yoon. Dan, welcome. Dr. Lawrence Yoon. Lawrence, welcome. For my audience that doesn't know, and you should know, this guy's been talking about the economics and what affects your business for many years. And we all know Dan from the show and at Inland. Dr. Yoon creates NARS Forecast, participates in many economic forecasting panels, C-SPAN. He's in Washington right now, not quite the White House, but next door, I believe. So with that, Dr. Yoon, Dan, welcome. Happy 2023.
Thank you for inviting.
So, Dr. Yoon, a little more background on you just for the audience. Dan, they know you, and we're going to jump into it pretty deeply. But how did you get your start? You and Dan have been in and out of rooms, lobbies for different things. How did you end up at NAR, really, getting your start?
Well, I was doing my economic doctorate degree at nearby university, University of Maryland. And as a research assistant, I was involved in the macroeconomic forecasting. They gave me this equation. It was related to personal consumption expenditure. And they said, well, try to polish that up, enhance it, so we can make a better prediction of the economy. And then, other students, focus on other part like investment. So that's how I got my economic forecasting sort of training part. And then once I graduated, while I worked in the Washington, sort of the consultancy field a bit, working on various government agency projects, then when the NAR job opened for economic forecaster, I didn't really know about the real estate as much, but economic forecasting. So I joined. Then, of course, over time, I learned this, I learned that, meet people like Dan, and then I understand the real world a little better. So it has been all good.
Well, Andre, let me throw in one more thing. I'm in the Chicago world. I'm coming to you live from Oak Brook, Illinois, at our world headquarters of Inland. But the Chicago Agent Magazine just has a really great story in it from Dr. Yoon. And I got to tell you, we have, as a part of the National Association of Realtors, we have 1.5 million members. And it's really the realtor family, and talking to a variety of our realtor leaders, all of them everyone just has such a warm place in their heart for Dr. Yoon. And we're all so proud of how Dr. Yoon, he represents our real estate industry in such a great way. And what I think is extra special is that he's able to take some very complex details and information and bring it down to where the average person who's listening to it can really understand it. And when Dr. Yoon, when you have to speak at all these different national places where people don't know, if it's CNN or whatever it is, they might not be aware of the details of real estate. You help make it to be understandable. And that's a very important thing to be able to do. But from all of us realtors, I just am so honored that you're here today.
I myself included there. It's since 2007, I'm a card-carrying member of NAR. Love it, what NAR does out in the world and for us as realtors, as brokers, commercial and residential. Just so you know, most of our audience is commercial real estate, some residential, some overseas. So we don't have to go too technical because, we're pretty straightforward people, except the institution side. But let's talk a bit about speaking out and what's happening in the world. Here we are, it's 2023. We're in the next 30 days, 3 months. We know what the Fed has done. We know tightening. We know there's this. What I want to ask you about is the shadow slump of 3 months where nothing's going to happen transaction wise. What are you seeing from where you sit? You've been at NAR 15 years. What are your thoughts and opinions to start in January?
Last year, in terms of the Federal Reserve policy, it was the most drastic raising of the interest rate environment since early 1980s, when Paul Volcker was the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Now, back then, inflation rate was running at double-digit pace for a couple of years. And Paul Volcker said, no, we cannot have the dollar lose the purchasing power. We have to get the economy under control, the dollar under control. So he said he will kill the inflation, even if it requires recession. So that's what he did back in early 1980s. Well, this time, 2022, inflation, of course, we were all frustrated. Go to grocery store, gas station, you name it, we are frustrated. So one way to contain inflation is to raise interest rate. Now, the side effect, the byproduct of that is it's going to slow the economy down. And certainly raising interest rate has greatly harmed interest rate sensitive sector. Housing is one. And it's in commercial real estate, as people need to refinance, pay off the loan that is coming due. And now they are looking at how much rents are coming in. But look, interest rates are much higher after one rolls over those payments. So therefore, the transaction volume naturally begins to slow down, because from property owner's perspective, they say, look, I own an apartment. I have high occupancy. You know, rent growth is pretty good. Here, I want this price. But the buyer is saying, no, the financing cost is much higher. So I have to offer you much lower price. And two cannot agree, and the transaction is not occurring. You know, a similar situation with other commercial real estate property types.
So based on 1980 and today, and I know these are uncharted waters, so we can say from varying factors, would you change what we've done, what the Fed has done over the last 2 years? Are we in a great place as an economy moving forward here in January? Great question.
You know, sometimes, you know, one look in hindsight to say that whether one would do something differently. But based on high inflation, which was running 9%, I mean, those are very, very high. Preferred inflation is 2%. Now, Paul Volcker would be an oddball. He would say 0% inflation would be good. But, you know, economists did a lot of the study to say 2% is probably a good thing to smooth things out. So that would be the ideal. But inflation was running at 9%. So, you know, one has to address that. But the question then becomes, why was inflation 9%? Was the stimulus perhaps a little too generous in terms of, you know, whether giving money to people, providing the loans, easy access loans to companies or to business owners? So we just flooded the economy with money. And one consequence of that is we got high inflation. So what is the right thing? Should we have done a little less on stimulus side, or keep the stimulus, but now the Fed has to pay for that by raising interest rate to help the economy? So, you know, Federal Reserve is doing its own thing. I'm not going to disagree or agree. You know, I'm just looking at what they have done, and this is where we are.
Well, I know, Lawrence, when you look at the money that was given for COVID, I think that a certain amount of that was saved so many businesses. But it got to the point, I think, that the last $1.9 trillion, I think that, from what I've garnered from different things I've read, was kind of the impetus for that 9%.
You know, people will study how much of the stimulus, you know, pushed up inflation rate by certain percentage point. You know, they will look at this in academic papers probably 3-4 years down the road. But the reality is that there was a massive spending into the economy. We need more production to accommodate this increase in spending. But what did we have? We had 3 million Americans leave the labor force, either taking early retirement or saying, you know what, this amount of money that I have in the bank, stimulus money, this will keep me a while for us. And then you had also the eviction moratorium, which, you know, from an AR's perspective, we should not hurt the landlord. They are innocent people. Why are you trying to hurt the landlord with the eviction moratorium?
Yeah.
So we asked for the rental subsidies to come along to say, if you want to help the renters stay in their places, it should be rental subsidy, not just simple eviction moratorium. But you consider some renters, you know, who are in difficult situation that certainly saved their lives, saved their career. But I'm sure there are some people who over abuse that to say, oh, I don't have to pay rent. I'm not going to pay rent. And maybe, you know, there's some people took advantage of that situation as well.
Well, in Chicago, you also, I'm sorry, under the other thing, in Chicago, you also have the issue of having to pay the property taxes are trying to be foisted more on commercial. So that's the other thing. And I'm so glad that the inland we got out of office when we did, because the office is so difficult for people because no one's going back to work. I mean, it's just, that's a big deal.
Well, and to be clear, I wasn't asking you to agree or disagree with hindsight. 2020 hindsight is always a thing. Where we are today, and I'm going to jump to office in a moment, Dan, great point. You brought up multifamily. We had a major influx in multifamily investment movement. An entire generation went from I'm going to live in a city to I'm going to live in urban areas. And they propped up prices with stimulation and all of this all coming together in a perfect storm. What did we learn from past recessions? Is the cycle shorter for us to come in here and be opportunistic? What do you see as your time at NAR specific to that economic trend? Are we in that opportunistic moment, which goes back to my shadow inventory question, or is everyone getting leaner and hiding out? It's an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it because it's going to Dan next on the reposition of inland and office. Dr. Ian?
Well, you know, at first, on the residential side, I should say home ownership side, there's a lot of emotions involved. But the commercial real estate, best thing about commercial real estate is there's no emotions. You are just looking at the numbers to see whether you make sense to invest this, whether opportunities show up. And right now, I think it's more of a face-off between the sellers and the buyers. Sellers are saying, look, the rents are good. I have high occupancy. I cannot reduce the price on my building, even though the cap rates would need to rise because interest rates are higher. But you know, the buyers are saying no, based on the financing. So that's why there was a little bit of standoff. But in other property, it becomes really opportunistic, especially where office market, we are seeing continuous rising vacancy rates throughout most big cities. And because this, and we're not done, because I think many companies are still unsure about what would be the right office space requirement, given that hybrid model, it looks like is going to be more permanent. Exact nature of it, is that 3 days a week come to office, or is it, you know, 1 week a month? Who knows what the right formula is? People will try different trial and error process in terms of worker retention versus worker productivity, cooperation, all that part. But we are not yet at an equilibrium. People are testing it out. But without a doubt, office space looks very vulnerable, which means that some people who may be financially constrained currently, they don't have a tenant, rents are not coming in, but their loans are due, maybe they want to unload. And this is where some of the investors can say, you know, I am willing to bail you out in some sense. You know, the owner perhaps will not get the full price or what they expected, but at least is to unload the property. And this is where the investors can possibly, you know, look at the numbers and then offer, even with possibility of repurposing after getting that property.
And repurposing, Dan, you mentioned it, inland pulled out of office. The repurposing of all these office assets, I mean, that is a major chunk of asset. That's the largest chunk of asset types. Studies are showing that even us working remote as a workforce that doesn't work, executives are fighting that, saying, no, we're going to cut down on our office. Why? Real estate is the top expense for a business behind salaries or above salaries. Cutting office as a business makes sense, if I can. But what's Inland doing, Dan, with office? Have you sworn it off, or is it something you're coming back to?
So what's really cool about Inland, we just purchased I think we're at $54 billion of purchases we've done in our over 55 years of being in business. And we still have the four teachers at the helm of Inland running the show, and having that kind of longevity and you know, understanding of the markets. They've been through these cycles. They know what it was like to go through the 80s. And it's pretty fun talking to them because they know this and they've gone through it. They identified, you know, Mr. Goodwin, Joe Cosenza, Bob Bamba, Parks, they identified, a variety of years ago that they saw this trend is starting where people are wanting to work more remotely, work from home. And this has been obviously the big trend with after COVID. So we already were involved with selling those assets, and we're really focused on the multifamily is so big for us. Also repurposing the different like Kmart buildings into self-storage is a big thing as well. Opportunity zones for us. Looking at student housing, senior housing, all these different areas are important. And obviously we've had hotels, you know, during COVID, the hotel world went down and we stopped distributions as people knew, but our investors understood it. And that's, you know, another thing that's coming back. It's really for, especially now when you're able to, have the ability to increase rents, I think that you have some really good performing assets for your investors. And that's what, you know, we have had the experience and knowledge of people to be able to do that here. The other thing is, you know, you talked about the lag, are we going to see, 3 months of no deals? Again, I don't mean to be like I'm showing off, but when you look at a guy like Joe Cosenza, who's really been responsible for buying all this stuff for Inland over 50 some years, he's like the Guinness Book of World Records winner of doing individual commercial real estate deals. So when you have that kind of experience, he knows of so many off-market deals that people would never know about because of that relationship. And so Inland's relationships would blow your mind through who we know and who Joe Cosenza, who, you know, all these folks know. And the other aspect is that with 1,100 employees, we have property tax, all these other divisions, and we're able to go in and understand different deals that other competitors wouldn't know. So having that breadth and understanding and that experience is everything, don't you think, Lawrence? I mean, experience is a big deal.
The relationship, the developing that connection. I mean, those are critical.
Your network is your net worth. Tried and true, regardless of your cycle. You've got to have the right people. That's why we do this. And I'm lucky enough to have Inland as part of my network and others. And NAR is the biggest network in the U.S., right, of real estate professionals that you can tap and work through. And you're never showing off at Inland because they do well. They're always buying. Inland is always buying. I love that tagline. But with so many eyes on the Federal Reserve, with interest rates where they are, and let's be honest, 80s, 90s, interest rates, double-digit interest rates, cost of capital is, as you said, Lawrence, it's just a number on a spreadsheet. As long as we can get the numbers to work for a deal, commercial real estate will happen, even if there is a significant stall out in residential because people are emotional, they can't afford it, or they've been propped up. Not putting words in your mouth. But would you say that that's true? That the commercial industry will carry on and do well over the next 3 months, 6 months, this year even, while residential still has to stabilize and there's going to be less volume in the residential market, potentially.
I mean, on the residential side, the volume, shrank around 18% last year, 2022, from the boom that occurred in 2021 or even 2020. That was 2 years of the boom in the residential sector before really coming down. Around close to 20% in 2022 from higher interest rates. So that was the reason. Now on the commercial side, again, initially there was a face-off. Then people begin to digest the information to say, because people understand the numbers and begin to say, only way to get the transaction done is to reduce the price. And overall, we are seeing some reduction in the prices on the commercial buildings. Some well-positioned property, of course, they are holding on, but the cap rates, given what's happening on the interest rate environment, the cap rates has to rise, which means that either one has to raise rents to cover that, or if they cannot, given the competitive pressures, only way to sell the property is to do a slight discount in the price. Now, on the apartment, which has shown the strength, I think going forward, view it as opportunity, a little disagreement on information, and this is where people begin to negotiate for prices, is that I think the rent growth will greatly decelerate this year. So apartment occupancy has been very strong, but we have so much pipeline of apartments coming onto the market, ready to hit the market. So this supply will begin to tame some of the rent growth.
Absolutely. So as operators became leaner with the economic headwinds coming in, what was projected, those projections are key. Some showing restraint in your projections on a stable, you know, you're going to buy that, reposition it. That stabilized asset may not perform as high as you predicted 6 months ago, those rent rolls. And that's a great piece of advice to really dig into those numbers. As far as shadow inventory and repositioning, do you see any indicators from where you've been? We've got regulation coming down. We've got funding for different programs to utilize these buildings. Is that a hot area to invest if they can hold on and get the funding?
You know, one big difference of, I think, where there is, you know, opportunities is the difference between the downtown and the suburbs. Again, you know, the work from home environment. You look at a restaurant. I'm here in downtown Washington. I feel sorry for all the sandwich shops out in the downtown area. They're struggling. Mm-hmm. Yet the restaurants out in the suburbs are doing well because it's the same people, the same individual. Do they eat in downtown or do they eat in the suburbs? But many are staying in the suburbs. They don't have to come to work every single day. Or the federal government, at least as of today, they still have the flexibility to remote work, and many are choosing that, which is the reason why the traffic is fairly light here in Washington because of those situations. So I think, you know, rather than viewing retail shop all equal, but of course it's not. I think the big difference is that the downtown is really beginning to see some weakness, especially near the business centers. Now, residential downtown area, I see some potential there. In the early months of COVID, people fled because of, you know, they don't want to catch COVID in a high density environment. And then the other part was, you know, the crime. People don't like crime. They see it and they say, no, I'm going to be out of here. So that condition. But at the same time, we have a large millennial generation. They need to live their life, and their life, they many consider to be in the city, walking the street. And as more people walk the street, this is actually a good crime prevention as well. You know, I mean, there's certainly some policy, but when there is a high density number of people walking the street, then that also provides a degree of safety. And I think people would then begin to relook at downtown living, along with, say, some of the retail shop that is in residential downtown area that could become very vibrant.
And I would highlight that, like, in the suburbs here in Chicago, Brookfield Properties owns Oakbrook Mall, Oakbrook Center, and that's going gangbusters. Oakbrook Center has provided more sales tax revenue for the village of Oakbrook than ever in the history of the town. They're really into Louis Vuitton is adding on. They can't get enough space. I mean, it's really very, very vibrant. And then on the other hand, because I think of the safety issues in Chicago, the Michigan Avenue has a variety of vacancies for retail. And I think you hit the hit it on the head in regards to people feeling safe. And I think they feel more safe out in the suburb, like an Oakbrook Mall, than they would, unfortunately, downtown right now. I know, Lawrence, I don't know if you've been to the NAR building recently, but I know folks that have gone there, they just are shocked at the difference of Michigan Avenue. Have you seen the difference?
First, you know, for people who are unfamiliar, the audience, the NAR building is located right next to the Wrigley building on Michigan Avenue. That is the prime real estate in Chicago. It is better than Fifth Avenue of New York City, pre-COVID.
Agree to disagree.
I was categorized in that sense. But I only visited one or two times, but it was just a simple taxi ride to the building, then going into the building, rather than walking around. So I cannot really make a judgment. But, you know, people need to feel safe in order to just, you know, do the shopping, window shopping, which then leads to emotional purchases. But if people are not walking the street, it makes it very difficult.
I will put a plug in for the NAR building. Is just beautiful, and they've done a great job renovating it. And it's really a terrific thing for our brand to have the NAR building in downtown Chicago, right on Michigan Avenue. And then you have another building in downtown or in Washington that it looks like a ship. I mean, it's another wonderful statement for everybody to see that the real estate community is here, and it kind of wakes up the legislators to make sure they're aware of the power of R. So it's a nice thing. But you're stationed in D.C., right, Dr. Yoon?
three blocks from the U.S. Capitol. On the roof, we can see the Capitol, which means the Capitol can see us. So we want to make that connection.
I love that. That's I want to jump in on, I want to unpack that mall statement, suburbs and cities, malls. We've got a big regional mall here. Apartments be going up next door. We've got a lot of, as Dr. Ian pointed out, a lot of affordable housing being developed to meet demand. So there's going to be this huge supply. Would you say then that your opinion is for investors that are longer term, 10 years, that they should go back and take a hard look at downtowns, those retail, restaurant, first floor, what have you, and office above, apartments above, those are those opportunities, those hidden gems. Because naturally people will go back into the cities. If 10,000 people turn 65 every day and are buying DSDs from Inland, hopefully, then how many millennials are coming of age and buying property? I mean, where's the biggest driver, that demand? Is it the city or the suburbs? I was hoping that everyone shifted to the suburbs, a whole generation. But it sounds like you're a city promoter.
right before COVID, up to 2019, we had a decade of movement towards the city. Families grew up in the 1950s, 1960s, out in the suburb, backyard, the dog and the fence. But the people who grew up in the suburbs, and I want to experience a downtown lifestyle. So you saw the growth in the downtown living, whether it was in Chicago, Minneapolis, just about everywhere, where some areas were really deteriorating, but people wanted to experience downtown. So there was steady revival. Of course, things like tax credit, incentives, opportunity zones really make it happen. So it was movement towards downtown. Then COVID completely reversed that. So people now went back to the suburbs. So that's where we are. And whether or not the next generation will want to have a taste of a downtown life, well, we have to wait and see.
I'm hoping for the downtown, the Main Street life. It's a missing characteristic. It's a wonderful thing. So we've got a post here from my partner and wife, Emmy Sirikaseni. Crime in one-bedroom communities up 27% in our area. So crime aside, but it's all about the numbers. Where's the demand? Where's the housing? Is where's Inland focusing their investment? Is there urban, suburban?
I think the big key to Inland investing is it goes back to the basics, where the housetop, the rooftops, where the jobs are, and the kind of the place that has the sun and the fun, is kind of where people are focused from our standpoint. When you're looking to securitize property, you want to make sure that you're in an area that's more stable, that you're not having big fluctuations of politics. So it's difficult, like in Chicago, it's difficult to buy something in the downtown because the assessor has tripled assessments in some cases. And so when you securitize something, that's a difficult thing to have a big swing in property taxes that you're not used to. So we're looking, the South, Texas, the Florida, Tennessee, those are the typical places. The other, the California is a wonderful place, but the legislative environment is so intense that, the idea of being able to afford the ability to do rent increases, and you have rent controls and things like that on each coast, it's a difficult thing where everybody's talking about that. So we're focused on more of the Texas, Florida, Tennessee, that kind of thing. We're open to also lots of other developments where there's a good opportunity, but in general, just doing a generalization, that's kind of what we're looking at. And I would say that the question about the crime in bedroom communities, like in Chicago, we have, crime is because of the large amount of crime in Chicago, we have it spilling over into the suburbs because they're like in Chicago, they're not keeping people in jail. They're letting people out. And when you have carjackings and you have our state's attorneys not arresting people in Cook County for stealing up to, I think, under $1,000 worth of items, then folks come out to the suburbs thinking it's going to be the same place. And so that's what I think is happening in some of the more urban areas. The crime, I think, is spilling out into the suburbs. That's my opinion.
And as far as construction starts, stops, this labor shortage, I mean, have you done any modeling on how that's going to affect the next 12 months, 6 months? We had a supply chain shortage. Everyone's aware of that. But at least here in the Northeast, we're still seeing this labor shortage on the job sites. So you spoke, and I'm jumping off a crime, Dan, I know, but jump right into real estate here. You spoke to about when we speak about developments and deliverables, there's a stall here in financing. There's a miscommunication between what I'm hearing on the left and the right, state by state. Unless we go south to those states Dan mentioned, they're thriving. Those were the top. You hit the top 5 out of 10 states for investment. To be fair, what is NAR's outlook, or what's your outlook as we come into this shift? I mean, it's the first time we've had this shortage in remote, this new work environment, remote work and lack of laborers to build, as opposed to lack of supplies.
You know, so right before COVID, again, going to 2019, did some research, worked with some people in the academic world, and trying to assess the housing shortage. And it was not only about the home ownership housing, but even apartment housing shortage. And there was housing shortage. We were debating within ourselves internally, is it 5 million housing unit shortage deficit, or is it a 6 million? Do we account for this? How does the census measures the population? How much error in their measurement? So as we were discussing all this, essentially we said there's about 5 to 6 million housing unit deficit in relation to the population, and also population with jobs. And consequently, how do we address it? So we looked at all the angles, you know, availability of construction loan for small guys. I know for the big guys that can go to Wall Street, raise some fund. But one other big thing that came out is exactly what you mentioned, which is labor shortage. We don't have a good number of people in the pipeline to come into the construction industry. We are heavily reliant on immigrant population to come show up, you know, whether it is illegal immigrants or people without documents. I know there's also very, very sensitive topics, but I think one has to really address that not all Americans are college bound, or they are not academically inclined. And if they're not, why don't we just say, look, here's some trade skills, welding, carpentry, and, you know, roofing and other part, it will give you a good middle income salary. And in the past, I mean, we just consider our grandparents. What do they do? What kind of occupation did they have? What kind of education level did they have? So it was not demeaning the occupation, but more as a, you know what? I am proud of myself. Why? Because I am bringing the finances for the family, and I'm glad that my family is you know, financially secure. So that was the pride that people went into. So whether it is welding, truck driving, you know, people need to have pride in that. And I think to say everyone needs to go to college, or that idea that we have demeaned some of the trade skill work, and I think we need to bring that back into the forefront.
Look, Dr. Yoon, you are absolutely right. And when you talk about trade, you know, we need to put the trades back into the schools and teach people that. I know, you know, the Carpenters Union, the Electrical Workers Union, they do a lot of training, and that's what they're trying to get more and more people involved with. I think you're absolutely right. The shortage of labor is just everywhere, and that's, you couldn't be more right about that. And when you also look at everybody saying, oh, I'm going to go get a 4-year degree. Well, we talk about those student loans, and, you know, kids are just, you know, it blows your mind of what people are facing when they're talking about buying homes. What is one of the reasons why they have to put off doing the home buying is because of a huge student loan payment. So all of this is interconnected. I think you hit on some good points. Good question, Andre. That's a really good question.
Thank you. The labor shortage, I mean, they, to be fair to the unions, because Associated Builders and Contractors, they've been out there pushing, right? And there's, I know a lot of very, very prestigious, prideful design build engineers. I'm not discounting them at all, but I think to Dan's statement, I think you're spot on. There is, it's a generational joke, but I'll say it because it's relevant. If you bought a car 30 years ago, the manual in the glove box told you how to take apart the engine and put it back together. Today, the manual tells you not to drink the battery acid. Nothing but do with how the engine gets put together. There's a basic skill set that we need to learn and cultivate. We've had 2 years of people at home, or worse, and not worse, remote, not being told or passing that on. Because when you're at home, you're in your own community. You're not going to get that outside education or that inclination to go do a trade. So how do we fix that? I mean, that's a tough question, but I'm going to ask it. What does that look like on a model? How do we recover from this now added pressure on that labor force? You said identified it at pre-COVID.
So aside from sort of moral suasion to say not everyone should be going to college, you know, especially those who are not academically inclined. You know, what's the reason for going to college? Take 7 years to graduate. And once they graduate, you know, working at Starbucks or someplace else and with a huge student debt, it doesn't make sense. So I think we are clear that there is a tremendous value in college education, but not everyone will fully benefit from it. So we need to provide that alternative path right away. I think the state of Tennessee actually also has the following. All the community colleges offer a free retraining of skills of those people who got laid off, recently laid off individual. They said, okay, which areas do we have a shortage of workers? If it's in the construction or welding, whatever it is, they said, we're going to put this person, offer them to get this training because job is available. Now, a person choose not to go into this training, of course, they're on their own, but they're essentially offering. Could other states sort of replicate this type of model? And then the financial incentives, you know, as long as there's a shortage of labor, that means the wages will be rising. And the rising wages itself will be an incentive to go into the industry. But if we, for example, I know, you know, college the student debt forgiveness, that's being discussed. But if it is forgiven, then it's still providing additional subsidies to go to college. But if it's not forgiven, then people weigh the balance. Is it worth carrying on the debt versus going to trade school, but much lower cost and more immediate income that comes along?
Well, and the other thing that is desperately needed is my wife worked, one of her clients is the Golden Apple Foundation, and the teachers. We need teachers all over the place. I mean, there's a huge shortage in New Mexico, and I mean, there's such a massive need for good teachers because COVID just really threw people for a loop, and a lot of folks retired, but the need for teachers is another one too. So we could go off into a lot of tangents here. I don't get to stay on real estate.
Right? Yeah, no, absolutely. We try to. Sometimes we do go off, but mentor. You brought up another good point. Mentorship. There's this big gap now between the generations. A lot of people came into the workforce, didn't even know how to go to the office, right? They graduated college and then they worked from home for 2 years. They didn't know how to transition. And those mentors, I think, are the key solution there. People that will guide the next generation into these relative roles. Apprentices, if we're talking labor and design, build, and engineering. But back to real estate, you made a unique point. You said financial security. And what is it a good time to buy real estate? We're all realtors here, right? Yes. It's always a good time to buy real estate.
Yes, that's the answer. What do you think?
That's the answer.
Say?
Yes. I'm just checking. We're all, but it's always a good time. So if we can invest, and maybe you're not buying the asset, fee simple asset, maybe you're buying deeds or tax liens. There are a lot of ways that these young professionals, I think Wall Street Journal calls them Henrys, high earners, not rich yet. There's a lot of money out there for people that can come into real estate. That may or may not be looking. And my thought is they should be, as is Dan's. What's yours? Real estate is the safest bet today, Lawrence.
I think everyone should have some of their financial asset in real estate. And of course, you know, homeowners automatically, they have some exposure to real estate just by owning a home. But even people who want to look at commercial real estate property, people need to recognize these are tangible assets. I mean, it's not like a cryptocurrency where there could either be a fraud or somehow disappear into the cyberspace in some way. This is a tangible thing that is right there that people cannot miss. And also, it's a good hedge against inflation. You look at the land prices or even home prices, commercial real estate buildings back in 1970. And you said, what was it back then versus what it is today? So despite all the business cycle or real estate cycle that go along with it, you look at the value and it keeps up with inflation. So, you know, price of Coca-Cola was very cheap, a long, long time ago. And, you know, it is what it is today. Same situation, real estate. My parents bought their first home I think in like $20,000, people will not believe. Believe me, you have to add at least one additional zero to the number. So that's a multiple 10 at the minimum in terms of how things play out. So real estate exposure, I think everyone should have that.
Well, and as long as you can zoom out, you can outlive, as you just pointed out, the business cycle, that economic headwind, as long as you invest well and you have the, commercially, as long as you have the returns to hold you through, to pay off your notes, and residentially, as long as you want to be somewhere you're going to enjoy. Although there's one other number we didn't talk much about. We've got all these homes being delivered, all these apartments, these different assets. But then we've got, I'm going to give you a blended number because I don't know the exact figure across the state of Connecticut, but 10% of the houses in Connecticut are vacant. They're, second homes, third homes. Are we going to see an influx of these apartments, these condos, these homes coming up for sale as constraints, economic constraints tighten everyone's wallets? Is that the model, the theory that these secondary homes will come up?
First assumption on economic recession, I think we are still debating on not whether we will go into a recession. Certainly like Ukraine, GDP is collapsing by 30% from the terrible situation happening there. Germany is probably going to go into a recession. The energy prices, because they were so dependent on Russian energy, is quite triple. It's just for homeowners who used to pay, say, $100 per month, now have to pay $400 per month, or the business community has to pay that amount. So it's a huge increase. And that's going to shave off some of the economic potential out in Germany. And since whole globally, we are interlinked in some way. I know there's more to self-sustain, trying to inshore some of the manufacturing here into the U.S., but still, we are still interconnected. So when Europe is weak, it's going to bring down the U.S. economy. But at the same time, there's still enough strength in the U.S. economy that GDP is running 1% or maybe zero, sort of bouncing along there. Healthy GDP number will be 3%. But let's do the worst case scenario. Let's say somehow the GDP really plunges, go down 3%. Well, that means that people will really struggle financially. They don't have the extra cash for that more luxurious discretionary spending like second home, second apartment. And that will hurt. But in my baseline scenario, in my forecast, I just have a sluggish economic growth. At the same time, job creation is a very unique situation. We have more help wanted sign than people who are unemployed. It's not a perfect match in terms of who lost job versus what's open. But we still have more job opening compared to people who are losing job. So given this scenario, I think people are finding jobs. At least they need to have some income. So overall income for the country is still rising. And one consequence of this hybrid work from home is, I believe, 10 years from now, it will be a very common phenomenon for Americans to have a second home within the extended family. What I mean by that is we currently have two cars in the garage. I mean, those are luxury compared to the past generation. But I think people will have the second home within the extended family as being a very normal, because I get to use that vacation home this week. Then my sister gets to use it next week. And then my uncle gets to use it the next week and so forth. Because everyone who has work office employment will try to schedule to say, I'm going to work remotely on this week. And of course, they are using the vacation home. So vacation home, I'm very optimistic over the long run, even though there may be short-term cycles.
Good for you for catching my back end into the where we are in the economy on that statement. Savings. Stephen Bielek wrote in, more savings and purchasing power in the 80s than today. As you just pointed out, you're bullish on where we are as an economy. We're growing. People are moving. Transactions are happening. Everything I'm hearing is reasons to invest, not to slow down. So why are we seeing lenders slowing down? Why, is it just because of the tightening on these forecasts, the rental concerns, the inflation cost of capital? Capital is not being written as fast. Back to my three-month window, Dr. Yoon. Is there a slump or are we bullish? Are we bearish or bullish in the next 3 months, the next 6 months, or the year?
I think the next 3-6 months is still uncertain environment. So caution. I think the banking industry would be very, very cautious. You know, they don't want to be holding the bag if the economy was to go into more deeper recession. So the banking industry are very cautious. The interest rate environment is saying, yeah, it is difficult to borrow money condition unless you want to pay more higher interest rates. So over the next 6 months, it's still very uncertain. And this is, again, you know, people who are more bullish over the long term take opportunity to say that, yeah, I know it's a little stretched to borrow the money, but I'm going to borrow it now, knowing that I don't have to compete with other buyers at the moment. Because, you know, when the other buyers show up, of course, you know, you have less chance to win that bid. So, you know, people should view it that way.
And then this is where Inland, as founded by teachers, right, advisors, mentors in and of themselves, if they can follow the leaders. I mean, who are the people out there, if you had to point to a group to follow? Obviously, Inland's one of them, given your close rate and where you are in your rankings. Are there anywhere else they should be looking as an industry, as professionals? Where can we look to see what to do, what to follow? Outside of this show, shameless plug, where do you look for your economic trends when you're building these out? Who do you look to? Dr. Yoon.
You know, so what Dan referred to about the southeastern states, you know, as one considers it, Connecticut, interestingly, had virtually no job creation over the past 20 years, from year 2000 right up to pre-COVID, you know, virtually none. Lockdown then knocked it downwards, and they're still trying to come back up. So sorry to say that about Connecticut, even though, you know, prior to that, Connecticut was considered one of the, you know, wealthiest state in the whole country. You know, everything was functioning well. Then things changed over in the past 20 years. But the southeastern states, you know, one was to use an analogy of the NCAA football league, the SEC conference. Those areas are just booming. People are moving to this area. The real estate prices are rising, but still relatively affordable compared to the New England states, certainly compared to the West Coast. So as people are migrating into the southeastern states, that's where there's a potential for, you know, you build an apartment, well, one do not have to worry too much about filling that up, you know, whether it's going to be filled up immediately or it's going to take a little longer, but people are continuing to move into the southeast region.
Well, and being in Connecticut and a broker and an owner, I have to push back a little. Connecticut is a great state with great things happening, but you have to be opportunistic and you need to take a long view in some areas. And I agree 100%. Heading south is always a smart investment, lower cost of capital, but you have people working there. I know the remote workforce we keep touching on. If you move to the south, you're going to take a hit on your income. Companies aren't going to pay you a California salary to live in Texas, as an example. Connecticut's the same thing. The Northeast is pays more. Minimum wage is higher and so forth. As far as job creation, Shelton was one of the top 10 cities in the U.S. for investment, not one of the Inland's primaries, but we've got a lot here. I have to push back. I'm the only guy in Connecticut on the call.
Can I ask you a question related to what do you think? Dr. Yoon, for our listeners, I'm interested. What periodicals do you read every day? Like, what are your go-tos to know what's going on in the world? What do you watch? If you could hit some of your typical day, what do you recommend that we do?
You know, first thing is I check the 10-year Treasury yield every single day. You know, I wake up and check that, but that drives the mortgage rates for your home buying. In a commercial mortgage market as well. So I look at what the government borrowing rate would be. You know, right behind me in the U.S. Capitol, they're debating on the debt ceiling. You know, there will be a lot of circus about it. Maybe there will be default for a couple of weeks, who knows? But I think people who are holding on to the government borrowing, government bonds, know they're gonna be paid no matter what. Even with 2 weeks delayed, you know, they're gonna be made whole in the process. So that's the very first item I look at, 10-year Treasury bond yield. Then other thing, you know, I look through all the financial news networks, you know, whether it's a paper, Wall Street Journal, and then you have the Bloomberg. the CNBC areas, and then I get some, you know, the emails that is thrown in my mailbox email every morning, and I scroll through that. Something interesting, you know, I click and see what's going on. So it's a variety of papers, and on the weekly magazine, I think the Economist magazine, the British publication. Every once in a while, they have a very good in-depth analysis of the commercial real estate market, a very, very thorough analysis, and I like that.
I love it.
Thank you.
Well, now, Dan, I got to phrase it back to you. What do you wake up and check for your news and what's happening in the relations world policy? Because then that to our audience, who should be paying attention? Go ahead.
I think with the devastation of what's happened with the newspaper industry and how things are changing, The best thing I read every day is the Wall Street Journal. I recommend that to everybody. I get it delivered to my house. I'm 55. I'm old fashioned. I like having a paper in my hand. I get the Chicago Tribune. I get our local suburban paper, the Daily Herald. But the thing that is the go-to for me in so many aspects is that the Wall Street Journal still has the resources to pay for some really good reporting, and I. That's my go-to every day.
I love it. I'm a digital native, right? So not a digital native in the generational sense, but Google Alerts, Wall Street Journal is a constant appearance, as well as you are, Dr. Yun, when you're speaking on different things. We're getting to the top of the hour, so we're right on time here. The Wall Street Journal, the periodicals, it sounds like big name papers or the Bloomberg, if we don't have it, the Treasury yield. Those are your two indicators. So really finding your market. Locally, the New England Real Estate Journal has been fantastic here. Very concise and great, great insights, as well as talking with roundtables like this, figuring it out. That's my go-to. Those emails, seeing what's what, listening to you guys. So here we are at the top of the hour. We've covered, employment, houses, the Fed, almost everything.
Crime.
Crime is the first for us on this show.
Yeah.
Double density changes. One other thing I will say about heading south, because I have to say it, going green by going south. It's cheaper and there's more sunlight, to your point, Dan, sunnier weather for all of the green initiatives, solar power. I mean, it's a great market. But don't count Connecticut out. We've got a lot of good things coming, just like Boston and Massachusetts. What is the, as we get to the end here, what is the one person in your mind, Dr. Yun, who should be paying the most attention right now? Is it the first-time home buyers, the real estate investor? Who has the most largest opportunity to profit? Is it the young professional who hasn't gone to college yet?
You know, I think there is this pent-up demand for housing demand, for commercial real estate. You can view it in more terms of, land development, land purchase, because there is a desire to own. People simply cannot own in this unaffordable environment of high mortgage rate. And with home prices having risen 30% in the past 3 years, I mean, those are huge gain in short span of time. So I think there is that desire, yet they cannot. But if there's an opening for opportunity, whether there's an increased supply coming onto the market, or whether there's a geographic migration to seek out affordability in the next county, exurbs, or even moving into different states. So I think this will be some of the big demographic driving pattern that is likely to occur.
Wow. So housing opportunities for those in shift, those that can shift, I should say, with the economics they need to. Dan, what is the biggest opportunity from a policy standpoint for people to be paying attention? Who should be paying attention to the changes that are coming out of the government policy? 1031?
So the good news is that there's gridlock in Washington, and that's probably the best news, because when you have just one party in charge, that a lot of stuff can get zoomed through. And so it's good to have the government where it's in the hands of different people. So we're not going to see anything, knock on wood, we're not going to see anything really major happening until after the next presidential election. There's going to be lots of drama, lots of circus stuff, but in regards to the very fundamentals of when you look at the tax policy, because tax policy is everything for real estate. We're looking at it probably not too much happening, which is also a little scary because some provisions are sunsetting. And I know that Lawrence, you're friends with Evan Lydiard, and he'd be another person to be able to go through and talk about some of these issues as well. But I'm very, in a sense, I'm very happy that we do have the Republicans now are in charge of the House, the Democrats are the Senate, and President Biden. So there's not going to be a lot of big changes right now.
So people are safe to make the moves they need to and follow that economic opportunity that yes. Dr. Yoon just pointed out.
Yep.
1031s are intact and safe. Yep. For those that aren't paying attention, pay attention.
And Lawrence, as we've been talking about the 1031 for all these years. the thing that's true that we realize in the industry is that it's always a part of our education. Now, we're not taking any assumptions that people know what it is. So we're always educating about the 1031, why that's important, why stepped up basis is important, why capital gains, you don't want to just totally kill the golden goose by taxing it to death. And I think Lawrence has been terrific in helping the realtors be able to explain that to members on the Hill.
Yeah. NAR's advocacy on the Hill, right? I mean, it is fantastic how much they teach us here on the ground locally and all they do for us in Washington. Dr. Yoon, thank you for everything you do explaining to the rest of us what's happening in the economy, because it's an interesting world where we can be opportunistic and every market is different. You torture the numbers long enough, they'll tell you what you need to know, depending on how you look at it. You're an economist, you get it. Whatever, you have to be selective in what you read, who you talk to, and what you're learning based on your experiences. So I want to thank you, Dr. Yoon, for coming on the show, talking about the economy, and really just being a great guest and friend to Inland. Dan, for coming on the show, and our audience, for everything they do. And our producer, Mr. Mendoza, as he starts to lead us out here at 6:56, top of the hour, because we are a timely bunch. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, for joining us. The Roundtable is available everywhere you get your audio, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, as well as live the first Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. Don't forget to join us, Dan included, next month.
Yes.
Thursday. And check out our YouTube station for recorded episodes, live episodes, different content. Dr. Yoon, what's the best way for people to reach you and find you? I believe they go on NAR site if they want to see what you're doing, what you're up to. Is that right?
So just Google into the place NAR research. So once you do the NAR research, there will be many of the research publications. Myself, my colleagues, we try to keep people updated on the latest trends on real estate.
And Dan, if people want to reach out to you over at Inland, what's the best way to reach you?
I love if you would just give me a call. I'm at 630-440-7770 is my personal cell phone. We have our main Inland number, but I love one of my favorite things is our people. So just give me a call.
Oh, building your network, because it's your net worth.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah. That's a Jonathan Stein saying. He said it to me first.
God bless give Jonathan him the plug.
He runs and runs. Yep. Network is your net worth. Hats off to everyone. Here we are in 2023. Happy 2023. Thank you for tuning in. As always, send your questions. Give us your feedback. The show continues to grow. Dr. Yoon, thank you for all you do. Looking forward to seeing you out there.
Dan, love you, Dr. Yoon. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.